Hello and welcome to Bitches on Comics. I'm your host, Essie Fleenor, and thank you for joining us for these flashback files. Right now, Bitches on Comics is on hiatus while we sort out some personal matters and get to work behind the scenes, making sure we can come back strong very soon. These flashback files are our opportunity to share with you some of the amazing work we've been doing over on Patreon. We're so happy to be back and so glad you've joined us. Please stick around for this flashback file where we share an episode that originally appeared on our Patreon. We would like to thank all our patrons and all our supporters who've been there for us through this whole amazing podcast. And if you haven't joined us on Patreon, you can do so at patreon.com/queerspec. On behalf of Sarah Century, Monica Estrella Negra, Kate Warner, and Supriya Saxena, I'm Essie Fleenor, and we're so glad that you've joined us.
Hey everyone, welcome to Mediums of Horror, a podcast series within a series brought to you by Bitches on Comics. My name is Sarah Century, and I am here to walk you through the creators, curators, and critics pushing the limits of the horror world. This episode, we're talking about horror criticism. Joining me today is Layla Latif, contributing editor of Total Film and host of Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Layla is also a frequent contributor to Sight and Sound, IndieWire, the BBC's World Services The Arts Hour, and if you check her website at laylalatif.com, you'll find a whole lot more. That is LeilaLatif.com, and if you missed it, check the show notes, we've gotcha. We'll have links in there and where you can find Layla online. This interview took place in late 2021. To kick things off, I made a note of how finding feminism in horror entailed me seeking out feminist horror criticism as much as it did finding feminist horror films, which wasn't always an easy thing to do. Here's what she had to say.
Yeah, I feel like it's like a Venn diagram of like the of all the gatekeeping, where there was kind of like what the kind of, you know, film journalism decided were the sort of films that were worth really like taking seriously, who was allowed to write about them, who was allowed to write about one aspect of them, who was getting any commissions that are all at the time. In fact, you used to just have these critics that would get their jobs kind of basically straight out of university and stay in them till they died. It was just one white dude who would just be like this major voice. And a lot of them were very talented You know, people that I still respect to this day, but it's just wild how little they cared about, you know, a variety of opinion. And I'm obsessed with this letter that Bill Gunn wrote after the American critical establishment tore apart Ganja and Hess, because that film was a huge success at Cannes, and it was the only American film selected to be in director's fortnight, and then he brought it back to America, and the critical establishment just treated it like it was just complete trash, even though it's a masterpiece. And he wrote an open letter, I think it's in the New York Times, but you can just find it online anywhere, all about how criticism was just like failing artists that weren't, well, in that case, white, but I would say it applies just as much to women and queer people.
Yeah, I mean, of course, because we have the very few where it's like, I mean, they do this in a lot of industries. They do it in comics, too, where they're like, oh, yeah, well, so how are we sexist if like Louise Simonson wrote like an X book or something? And it's like, well, that's one that we had, you know, and I think that that's kind of an ongoing thing. I know the letter you're talking about because I read that as well. It is a very interesting letter, and it's fascinating because I'm sure in the time people were very like sour grapes about it or something, but it's like, no, everything he said was dead on. Like, that is, it's a movie that we now like universally consider to be a classic, right? Like it's been re-released by the Criterion Collection. Like, there's a lot of critical thought around that film, and it's been, in recent years, I feel like it's really kind of made its comeback in a way. But it's like, this is the thing, is like, he passed away like years ago, right? You know, so it's like, a lot of times this stuff never actually really benefits the artist within their lifetime. So that's like an issue on top of it, because we should have had more Ganja and Hesses, right? Like, after a film like that, that guy should have had his pick, you know, of what the next thing he was going to do was. And it wasn't like that at all.
Yeah, no, it is really sad, especially just knowing that, he, you know, when he died, he probably had no idea that there was any chance that he would really have much of the legacy that he's had. Yeah, really, really sad. And in a way, kind of, Ganja and Hess shouldn't have survived in the way that it did. It's just kind of some bizarre fluke that even that there was any copy of the original. I think it was the New York, a museum in New York just kept a copy. But aside from that, like, you know, I guess conservation is such a massive important part of films. I think a lot of the time people don't realize that, you know, stuff gets destroyed and it simply can never be found ever again. And I think it's a problem that's actually getting worse. Like, established films that I should be able to find are impossible to get. Or recently I was writing about African films and it's just like, they basically barely exist. There aren't any copies, you know, and like big works that were like important things. It's kind of virtually impossible to get any copies of. It's terrible. Sorry, that's such a bummer. We've moved off topic, but...
No, not really at all. I mean, I think that this all has a lot to do with it and, like, how important this stuff is. Because if you're looking at who gets to choose, right? Like, that's always the thing, is like, where it's... We have organizations that are about preservation pretty specifically that, like, will go through, comb the archives, find what films, you know, are worthy of being taken care of. But that's something that is, like, in and of itself such, like, a politically loaded, like, you know, which films are worth it. And, like, that's where a lot of people can be like, well, I don't think it's so important that we work to preserve these, like, two surviving reels of five of, like, this, like, you know, the first Vietnamese woman filmmaker, you know, or something like that. It's like, you'll see stuff where we will lose that because people don't consider it to be important. Like, how many of, like, Lois Weber's works are lost, you know, just because people were, even in her own day was erased for her work and people were just like, this person straight up doesn't matter. Like, just made, like, women's films or whatever, which was not the case. But it's, like, it's interesting because that's something we view, like, obviously there's been a lot of to-do made about how the silent era is, like, ravaged by time. Like, there's, what, like, 20% of them ever made that still survive. So we have actually no idea what silent film was like because we only have, like, 20% of the films made to see.
I didn't realize it was that low. That's horrifying.
This is, like, possibly a made-up number, but, like, and of course we find reels all the time, so who knows, but it's one of those things where it's like, it is such a small sliver of what we saw before. But as you know, this is an ongoing problem. This isn't something that's going to vanish. Like, there's I wrote for Sci-Fi Fangirls for a long time, and we're about ready, the internet is about ready to just, like, take all of the articles off pre-January 2019. But that was a site that was doing a lot of feminist criticism for, like, a 3 or 4 year period. So it's like, there's going to be a big hole where it looks like nobody was talking about this stuff, right? And, like, that is why wild to me, because it's like, we're in the age of the internet, so you shouldn't necessarily be able to lose things that easily, but we do.
Yeah, it's bizarre because we do have this strange idea of, like, when things are online, they're online forever. But, like, I think that's because it's kind of only dawning on us that, like, that's really not the case. And even when it comes to digital film, like, there's all this stuff that I've been reading about how even, like, digitizing stuff degrades films as well. And, like, so we were actually, like, the preservation of a lot of these things is not doing well simply by having them online.
This is something that comes up a lot. I did a lot of volunteer archiving work, and I think that it's important. It's especially important when we're talking about, I'm going to say, like, people of color across across the world, but then also queer people, women. It's one of those ongoing things where it's like with queer people, I think something people don't always understand is that the only way we find out anything about like queer history is like who got arrested, basically, right? Like, because it's like you look to the past and people were like burning the letters that were written between lovers, like, you know, burning any trace of the stuff, because it's like back then it was like, oh, that's like something that's like actually really wrong with them, right? So like to avoid tarnishing people's legacy, they would just destroy it. And it's interesting because like the only way we discover things is through these like very sparse records, but records get destroyed as well. So it's like this just ongoing thing of like we really only we have to work to preserve history and like our commentaries on history too, I think, because whenever we're talking about this stuff, like, you know, you look back and you see the opposition to a film like Ganja and Hess, but like I'm sure that people loved that movie too, right? Yeah. So it's just like we don't hear that part. We see like his response and we see like the condemnation of the film, but we don't see like the dissenting viewpoint. And I think that that's a big issue as well, like when we're going into criticism and talking about like the importance of criticism to horror specifically.
Yeah, God, that is an interesting point that even, like, I kind of didn't even consider that. Because it was such a kind of European, it seemed like all of, like, when I was looking into Ganja and Hess specifically, it seemed that everything that I could find that was positive was just from European publications, which I could kind of run through Google Translate and get a sense of. But yeah, I'm sure there would have been, like, smaller journals and, you know, things that just didn't have the record keeping of the New York Times that would have existed at the time, but, you know, sadly lost to history.
Yeah, it's a thing where whenever you go through archives, you find this stuff sometimes. Like, you'll find, like, zines and stuff that are, like, a little bit of a dissenting viewpoint. And, you know, stuff that'll be like, and it's kind of across the board. They do it happens with music too, where like bands that were like dismissed will have like somebody being like, no, I love that band and here's why, and that kind of stuff. So I think it's that stuff's always really important, but it also plays into what role criticism plays now, right? Because I think that it's not necessarily a coincidence that as we're seeing a surge in, I believe, feminist horror criticism, like we're also seeing a lot more diversity behind the camera.
Yeah, huge.
And like, it seems like there's like this kind of perhaps an alliance forming between the critics and the creators that's kind of just like by talking about these things and by not neglecting them, because that was like the thing of like actively neglecting them for such a long time. Now we have critics who are like, you know, very happy to discuss like the nuance of like the new Candyman or something like that, right? So yeah, how do you feel about that?
I think horror is one of the areas where it feels like criticism matters way more, because the films don't tend to be sold so much. I mean, obviously you get like a Scream, but like for the most part, these are lower budget films, and they're films that aren't necessarily sold off the backs of movie stars or giant press tours. And so word of mouth and like reputation and hearing about like, you know, that there's something really special out there seems to be particularly significant within horror. Like something like, do you remember earlier this summer, there was this film, The Empty Man, that like just, I don't think I saw one official bit of like press or right. marketing for. It just seemed to be that every like subreddit or, you know, and bit of social media was getting out there, and then slowly the horror journals would come through and the podcasts and stuff like that. And I think, yeah, horror allows somehow for organic growth, and I think it also doesn't seem to be as tied to like release dates. I feel like with, let's say, an action film, there's a sense of like, oh, it's the new one, whilst horror tends to be, I mean, maybe this is a gross oversimplification, but I feel like horror fans are also very willing to kind of look into the past and kind of follow threads of like, oh, I'm into this and I'm going to watch it, and then I'm going to watch all the things that influence it, and I'm going to kind of do deep dives into, you know, a whole subgenre, which I just don't think really exists outside of horror fandom.
I was thinking, too, that maybe criticism changes a little bit because you're looking at, for instance, when you're there's all kinds of movies in this world, but whenever you have horror films, they're kind of intended to be upsetting, right? So it's like a very interesting role that horror plays. I feel like the role of criticism changes with horror because of the violent nature of horror. Like, for instance, there's all kinds of scenes where if like that, the tone of that horror movie was like in any other film, you'd be like, this movie's terrible and it makes me feel bad. and then when you watch it as a horror movie and you're just like, yeah, of course, these themes make perfect sense where they are. So I do think that there's something kind of interesting about that. And I just wonder, do you think that criticism does change due to the specifically upsetting nature of horror?
I do, but I think that horror is also kind of victim to some of the worst criticism, and I wonder whether this is something we're going to lose, but it seems so frequently you still get at the beginning, particularly in like big publications, of I hate horror films and I don't think this one is very good and here's why. And it's just like, well, why do I give two shits what you think, to be honest, if you've written off an entire genre within like the first few minutes? And I feel that, like, because horror wasn't necessarily respected as much within those spaces, that was permitted in a weird way. And I think we're moving away from that. And probably, as much as I like friggin' hate and spend way too much time on Twitter, like, I do think that there's like a slight outrage that could be like expressed in a like more egalitarian way of like, hey, this is actually a show or a horror film or a show that's come up that we were all looking forward to, we actually care about, and you're being incredibly dismissive of the thing that we care about. Obviously the downside to that is that, like, currently my friend Charles Promesco is being ripped to shreds because he said Ghostbusters 4 is bad. So, like, there's clearly a bad side to that fandom. But I think for horror, it actually tends to be more in a positive because we are, as a kind of bit of culture, slightly the underdogs.
Yeah, I was thinking because there's the fact of with horror, I hear this all of the time where people will be like, oh, I don't like horror. And it's like, well, why? And for my friend group, generally it'll be people being like, well, it's misogynistic. And it's like, okay, like, that's fair, but it's also not, because it's like, obviously, like, so many feminists have interest in horror, and that the ideas of like feminism in horror are nothing new. Also, of like, feminist writers have been destroying this genre for like the last many several years. Like, just absolutely, like, I mean, I took a break from reading horror novels and I've jumped back into them over the last couple years, and it's like the way that women have just like taken this genre as their own, essentially, is like kind of embarrassing for everybody else, you know, because like it's definitely notable how like women are absolutely leading the genre, and I believe that that translates to film as well. But it's also interesting because it's one of those things with, you know, when somebody doesn't like, somebody likes Johnny Cash but they don't like country music or whatever, so you'll hear somebody be like, oh, I only like Johnny Cash but he's not really country, right? And it's just like, no, he's very country, my friends. Like, he's the man in black. He's very, very country oriented performer. All of his songs are 100% country songs. They have 1-2 shuffle beat. Like, they are 100% country songs. So a lot of times people will be like, oh, I only like this one critically acclaimed horror movie that's released every year, you know, like we always have one.
Yeah.
That all of the people can watch, right? Like, it'll be like Midsommar last year, you know, like, where people, they feel comfortable with it. But the thing with horror, I think that's the most important, is that it's such an amorphous genre. So, like, it's in everything. Like, there's horror in regular old movies all of the time. Like, you see horror themes in all kinds of genres. Like, you will, it's like, it's one of those things where people are very comfortable borrowing from the genre. And like enjoying it from like a distance, but not necessarily like admitting that, yeah, sometimes they like horror movies. And I think that that's just kind of fascinating because it's like they feel like they would have to justify enjoying a horror movie. Yeah. It's like, you like them all of the time, though. Like, we've all seen them and enjoyed them.
And then pretend that they're thrillers, not horrors, which is always the one that I find weird. Like, I think that happened a lot to Get Out, because it was also not a difficult film to watch as far horror films go. Where it was like, oh, this is mislabeling, you know, this is kind of satire that is using horror tropes, or this is a thriller, I heard a lot. And I do love Jordan Peele from coming up and like, nope, I made a horror film.
Yeah, because he did. Like, this is something that's 100% like Number 17 Looks Just Like You from The Twilight Zone and like The Stepford Wives. Like, we have seen this in horror a lot. The fact that a story like that hadn't been told yet 100% has to do with like the gatekeeping of the industry, I think. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting how that works both ways in a lot of times. Like, it's like, not only are people traditionally kept out of working in horror, but it's like, when somebody wants to take a filmmaker seriously, they're like, oh, you did not make a horror movie. Get Out is 100% a horror movie. There's no arguing that. It's terrifying. That's a scary movie.
I wrote about this this phenomenon that happened in Britain, that was the video nasty legislation, where they kind of decided that like horror films were coming in and polluting our kids' minds, or everybody was gonna grow up to be like a mindless serial killer. Because, like, you know, kind of monkey see, monkey do, I guess. Like, literally, like, that was their level of, like, understanding of psychology. But, and, like, as much as I think at least that's been gone, I think there's still a tiny bit about that left. And I think particularly when it comes to feminist horror, there's a sort of, I think there's an assumption that it's kind of tied to kink, which I think is often like a really like unfair approach, that like, oh no, this is just sort of all born out of a desire to have violence enacted on you as a woman, and that's coming from like a sexual place, whilst kind of men are, you know, afforded all these complexities to the reasons that they enjoy things. It's like, yeah, no, it's a rough thing having been a female horror fan that was born in the 80s and as a black woman and as a person who like grew up surrounded by like heinous cultural misogyny. Like, I feel like I'm only now just like picking myself out of the weeds to like what I like for the kind of sincere reasons.
Yeah, I understand that to some extent. Horror was always considered kind of fun and goofy where I was raised. Like, it was, could be something that was like just violently misogynistic, because a lot of those films from the 80s really are. But then like, it's like there's more to them still. But yeah, I find it so interesting, because there's kind of ongoing conversations about like where you should draw the line whenever it comes to horror, right? Because it's like, I think a lot of people are like, oh, well, this is like the horror that I enjoy, and then there's that horror which I am not into, and like anybody who's into that is weird or whatever. And it's like, I'm one of those people who's just like, okay, so I will probably never watch The Human Centipede, but I think that I've seen feminists like enjoy that movie. I've seen people be like, oh, that movie's hilarious. Or like, you know, I've had people come at me with like any number of different things. And it's like, it doesn't have to necessarily be for me. Like, I'm probably never going to sit all the way through Cannibal Holocaust, but like a lot of people view that as an important movie. And so it's like, I'm always kind of one of those people where I'm like, I don't really see where we draw lines on this stuff very clearly, because it seems very, very arbitrary.
Cannibal Holocaust I'll defend more than I think I should, because I think it is an interesting film and I do think it has ideas. My issue with Cannibal Holocaust is that they hacked real animals to pieces.
They sure
to
did.
Make Cannibal Holocaust.
But they did that in like El Topo, and like they did that in like Apocalypse Now, right? Like, so this, like, it's not unheard of whenever we're talking about movies that we consider to be important over the last century that something like that happened, right?
I mean, which is even like, the Twilight Zone movie, three people died, I think.
Yeah.
And it's just like, and I get that like I get that you don't need to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but it's like, to me, there's just like a point at which I cannot entirely get past. And I think I watched Cannibal Holocaust before I knew that, and I watched it years ago and I haven't come back to it. But yeah, I think that sort of draws a line for me where I'm not really particularly interested in it. I would just say that it's interesting to me that we talk about horror getting like increasingly elevated, which sure, that is happening to a certain degree, but to me it does still seem like in the 70s there was a wave of like horror films that had like a significant number of ideas, and then that just dropped off so significantly. So I think it's like sometimes things are simplified as being like, oh, it's like now that horror has all of these ideas, and it's just like, well, no, it's just that like we forgot about what it could be for a while. And this is a wave, not a kind of apex, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, have you read the novel We Eat Our Own?
No, I haven't.
That's basically like a fictionalized retelling of the story behind Cannibal Holocaust. So that it's a pretty interesting book. It's very strange, but it's pretty great, honestly. But like, yeah, I think that to your point, kind of, yeah, this is what I'm getting. Let me know where I'm wrong. But like, what I was thinking was that when you really draw a line is whenever the harm is done to a person on the set, or like a living creature on the set. Like, that's kind of like, for me, one of the big things where I'm just like, I watch a lot of movies where I'm like, I believe that these actors talk to each other, you know, before this scene. I believe that actors are surprisingly adept at being able to take care of themselves on sets, and that they have to be in a lot of ways. But like, that's the thing is like, they also need protection on sets, and there's a reason for that, because actors have been famously abused on set, particularly women, right? And yeah. So you have this kind of long history, but to me, that's always where I draw. It's like, that's where things get ugly, is when you're just like, oh, this person was like hurt behind the scenes. But when you talk about something like that, like, nobody is having that same reaction to like, what is that movie, Last Tango in Paris or whatever, where is that the one where Marlon Brando like literally like raped a girl, like while the like get the realism of the scene.
It's a real, real common thing that you find in, I'm writing about sex scenes at the moment, and kind of going into all of that, and it is fucking horrific, a lot of it, but some of the stories are just very, very upsetting, and a lot of them are recent, but there was generally, it seems to have been up until about, I don't know, 15 years ago, that in order for a woman to give a performance where she is, something traumatic is happening to her, she has to genuinely be traumatized on set. Like, we kind of
the Kubrick method, right?
Yeah, where it's just kind of like, we didn't have any faith in actresses to act. It's bizarre.
And like, actresses that have done incredible work, like, I, whenever we hear about like The Shining or something, and you're just like, anything I see Shelley Duvall in, like, she did like a one side appearance in like a Twilight Zone of the 80s, and she's like crying real tears, you know. It's like, every time I see Shelley Duvall, I'm like blown away by her skills as an actor. Like, she's one of the great actors, one of the great unsung actors of her era, I think, and just cries like on a cue. And then it's like, for some reason, that translated to like Kubrick needing to like torture her on set to get an authentic performance. Do you know who didn't have to be tortured on set to get that performance? Jack Nicholson, for some reason. So like, it just is such an obvious like, oh my God. Yeah. And it's like such an ongoing thing, right?
But it is mind blowing how recently like so much of this stuff is coming out about like, on this, I've been interviewing a lot of Game of Thrones people of late, and like, they literally, like, that poor woman who's now in Ted Lasso, like, there's a scene where she had to be, like, tortured by, you know, that mountain guy, and they just kind of waterboarded her for 30, like, is she called Hannah Waddingham or something? Like, did you watch Game of Thrones?
I didn't, but I, because of this, right? Yeah, no, I was like, I can't do it. Like, I really can't.
Oh, yeah, no, she kind of plays a sort of a kind of a villainous person. Like, nobody's a good guy in Game of Thrones, but anyway, she's like a nun.
But then it's used to justify it, right? Which is always gross.
Yeah, they just, like, literally, there's a scene where the fate of her character is that she's going to be tied to a bed and tortured, and she was just there for hours just being waterboarded. Basically, it was just absolutely horrifying. And even things like intimacy coordinators are so new. I think we're talking like 2017. And I've heard so many horrific stories, like not necessarily from horror films, but actually one of them from a set of one. And you have to keep some of these things anonymous, of just like the most horrific, like sexual harassments happening through the medium of like, oh, well, we have to, you know, get this scene right, and we have to kind of have this sexual moment, or we have to have this moment where your shirt is ripped and you will be like basically nude or covered in blood, and we will keep you that way for hours, and like weirdly the set will be filled with like 30 more people than there needs to be. It's just it's grim, and it's recent.
I think that that's one of those things too, because like I'm gonna say like, because what always ends up happening is that this turns into a conversation around whether or not sex scenes should exist in film, right? Mm-hmm. And I am obviously a proponent that they should.
Yeah,
there is great examples, right? But like, as we talked about here, is like so much of that. So like, something for me as a queer person that always comes up is like blue is the warmest color versus ammonite, right? Because mm-hmm. blue is the warmest color, like those actors were treated like shit, you know, like they were treated horribly. And that is like one of the, it's like to this day, like some of the stories off of that set are like ones that just like, they are so goddamned upsetting. And then you see ammonite, where you have like Kate Winslet has like come out, talked about the sex scenes, been like, this is like something that we planned, we talked about, like we coordinated our own scenes with each other, and like, you know, there we like were allowed to have close set stuff, like, you know, all of these things. I feel like when you watch those movies, it's literally like night and day. The effect is like, you super don't need to torture your actors to get a good sex scene, because it's like the ones in Blue is the Warmest Color still just read as being so uncomfortable, because it's like, as a queer person, like, you watch that stuff and you're just like, that's not what sex looks like. Like, these two are like uncomfortable, like they're contorting their bodies, and like they look like they were just crying, you know, like they, it's like it doesn't work.
I'm sure they were doing like 10 hour sex scenes, like without a break. I mean, like, I
horrifying.
Think it's so unnecessary, and it's like, and you just know that they know that it's unnecessary, and it comes from a really dark place. But then like the kind of sad legacy of those things is then, you know, the press is so misogynistic as well, that then when Lea Seydoux gets cast as a Bond girl, this is like weaponized against her.
I know, it's so gross. And like, also the way that both of those actors were like, we'll never work with that guy ever again, like it's like the stuff that they went through is like, I wouldn't blame them for just never working in film again, honestly, because like that stuff is real gross. And a lot of actors have been pushed out of the industry doing stuff like that. So I think too, that whenever I watch something like Ammonite, it's like, not only is everything, like you appreciate hearing what the actors had to say about it, but then on the other hand, I think it just makes a better movie, because they literally were given the room to do the acting, and it's like a hot movie. So I think that there's just a lot of difference there. But like, that's, you know, we had like a gay male director on Ammonite, and like, it's definitely like a straight man who's since been called out for sexual assault on Blue is the Warmest Color. So it's just kind of a complicated situation, but it also is one of those where it's like, as you say, you don't have to torture these people to get good performances. They're literally actors, and it's better if the director is like, you can see the director all over the scenes in Blue is the Warmest Color. Like, you can see it, you know, it's just a different world from watching something where it's actually made well.
Yeah. And I wonder whether that is also just a symptom of kind of the misogyny of the establishment, that nobody could see, like if you're kind of putting that sort of straight male lens, slightly leering lens on kind of two women having sex, and then you're presenting that to a certain group of, you know, film distributors and film critics and like stuff like that. Like, nobody's actually going to even identify that there's anything wrong with it until like way down the line.
That was what happened, right? Because mm-hmm. it was like, I remember everybody being like, you have to watch this movie. And then I went to go see it and I was like, yo, like, what do you all think I'm about? Because like, this movie is weird. It's like, I love, like, I am the person who's like, oh, it's 3.5 hours long, French, like, sad, I will watch it, right? And then I watched this one and was just like, this is messed up. She calls her girlfriend like a whore. Like, you know, it's like, there's like so many things in it where it's just like, I can appreciate, but then like the comic, right, that it was based on is like a completely different story, and it's all kind of about like the homophobia that this person undergoes for being queer and like how that it works. So it's just like a, the way that it worked out on the screen was very upsetting to me on multiple levels. But one of the biggest ones, of course, was like how salacious like the sex scene was. And it's like, well, Chantal Ackerman did a sex scene in like the 70s and nobody gives a shit because it was a lesbian who did it. So like, you know, it's like, or like a queer woman, you know, like who did it. So it's just like, that's the thing is like this random straight dude comes around in like, you know, 2010 or something. And everybody's like, he's a genius. Like, and it's just like, I don't know, man. But then, of course, like, I think a lot of films are still kind of dealing with the fallout of movies like that, like where it's like you're still dealing with the fact that, you know, people are going to be really critical. It's the same almost with horror, where it's like people are extra critical of horror and how that's going to turn everybody into murderers and stuff. And it's just like, but we get like so much violence from like cop dramas, right? And like nobody blames that for it. So I don't know. I think it's kind of like an interesting thing, but that's where critics come in, right? It's like to kind of try to parse this.
Yeah, something like The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard is like got a death count of like 200 people, and like it's so disposable and nobody gives a damn and people die and like it just doesn't matter. Like fundamentally horror is like, oh my god, the fear of death, you know, like there's weirdly, I think like horror is way more anti-violence than most things. I mean, even kind of with your kind of schlocky horror kind of B-movie silly horror comedy, there's like a sense of like, oh my god, this is a really bad thing that's happening.
I think the same, because it's like there's so much dismissiveness if you're watching like a cop drama or something to like, and then like in real life we have so much issues with police violence, but like that's something that like even in shows they're just kind of like, yeah, so what, they killed like, you know, dozen people or whatever, but like no big deal. But yeah, as you say, in horror, like the people are like freaking out because it's terrifying. So it's like almost anything, almost any death in horror is treated with like more gravity, right? Than like, you know, general deaths are, unless it's like the buildup of like a child's movie or something, right? Like Mufasa dies or something, then that's like, obviously. Oh,
God. Yeah, not recovered.
No one has. None of us ever will. thanks a lot, Disney. So I want to go back, like I just want to go back a little bit because we jumped like right into this conversation. It's been really fun talking to you about like all of this stuff. But I did want to ask you a couple of things about like your personal relationship with criticism and with horror. So is there, do you have a specific, you were kind of saying like you had gotten into horror at a time whenever it was considered to be like not cool. And I think too that like whenever you're thinking about criticism, that's something where I think me having books of like criticism on my shelf was always something where people were like, why do you read this stuff? Like, you know, or it's like the adage of like, oh, critics are just like a bunch of haters or like anything like that. I think that that image is changing over time, I hope, because it's more about like a love for the genre, right? Like if you're working this much on criticism, you're not usually like indifferent to it, like you actually really care about the stuff that you're writing about.
Thought. And then I watched the recent Candyman and I was just like, oh, they still hate us? Okay, cool.
Right. Okay. See, I haven't seen it yet.
There's a critic in that that's kind of like almost like the critic in like Ratatouille level of unbearable.
Right. Gotcha. And that is part of like the commentary around Candyman in a way too, though, right? Because it's like even in that first one, there was the academic pushback against Helen trying to do this research or whatever. So I have recently seen that movie, and I remember there being like a truly insufferable academic, which I think is. If for a lot of creators, maybe interchangeable, like, yeah. I don't think that, like, there's a lot of people trying to understand.
Oh, I love that unbearable guy. And I remember that scene so well. They're at the dinner and they're all chain smoking whilst they eat. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, what the hell was the 80s?
Yeah.
But oh yeah, I think I'm trying to think like where my love of horror. I kind of grew up with a lot of Hitchcock, and then I was born in like 85, so the time I kind of went to uni was like tail end of the slasher thing. I was always like slightly too young for the stuff that I wanted to watch growing up, so it was like around the kind of 12 mark probably when like that Scream, I Know What You Did Last Summer sort of wave was coming up. And then by the time I got to 18, there was a little bit of, I think, a slight lull in it all. Kind of a trend of, it's like really like late entry horror franchises and really, really bad ones. And then sort of the stream of like Michael Bay doing a lot of very bad remakes of the classics. Of like, you know, you get the Texas Chainsaw Massacre where like... somebody had a vagina in their somebody had a gun in their vagina, not a vagina in their gun. Yeah, like just like, and their whole thing of like, what we're gonna do is we're gonna take these films of the 70s and we're gonna add even more misogyny and throw in like way more sexual violence. So it was like not a good time to be like in your 20s and a horror fan. And then I suppose so then that time I just always watched more like stuff from the 70s, and because it seemed like a bigger cut above. And then, I mean, I hate the term elevated horror, but I guess kind of like post Get Out, there has been something of a renaissance. I mean, it's like, I guess it's like the trio of it, right? It's like Hereditary, Get Out, and The Babadook sort of seem to create this like new wave, and it's been pretty good ever since. Like at least in terms of like, it does, yeah, in terms of like feminist horror, like it does seem like there is just more and more each year.
Because there was that time period where all horror was just like really strongly CGI, like 2005 starring Ryan Reynolds or like whatever. And I think that that was like a bad time for horror in a way. Like it was a financially successful time for horror, but it was all remakes or like something like Hostel or something where it was like, even if it wasn't a remake, it really did just push like the gore factor of things, and once again was still like unbearably misogynist, more so than you would think like a lot of the older films are, because at least we had our final girls or whatever, and in these movies it was just like open season on women essentially. So I think that that's interesting, because I had a similar, I was born 2 years before you in 1983, so it's like when you are of that general age, right, like you have an interesting relationship with horror, because from my childhood, most childhood films I think were kind of horror. Like you have like Return to Oz, that's like a horror movie pretty much, right? And then like Labyrinth even is like a horror movie, like these Dark Crystal, these are all horror movies essentially that like tell you a lot of things about life and like what to stay away from, you know. It's like there's I don't know any movie that instilled in me to like beware the charming creeper that like Labyrinth did, right? Like, yeah. And you know, these are movies that to this day I think really hold up, but now there's a much stronger line, I think, where it's like, no, these are children's movies, and then this is the horror genre. Like, there's some crossover, but it's usually aesthetic. Like, you have something like Hotel Transylvania, which is like just aesthetics, right? Yeah.
And even you see something like the Addams Family, as that's kind of evolved, kind of, you know, all these different iterations. And I hear that, well, I saw the first, the most recent one, not the second one, which I hear is absolutely dire. But it's like, it's getting kind of cleaner and less sexual. Whilst, I feel like we miss something there. And like, I always loved reading Roald Dahl when I was younger, and I used to like reading his adult short stories when I was like 12, and I kind of moved on to slightly darker stuff. And I love that sort of like propensity for like wickedness that I, you know, like it spoke to me as a kid.
Yeah, I think so. And it's interesting, once again, because we talked a little bit about how horror can be a little bit amorphous and like how it kind of shows up in all of these interesting places. I think that, yeah, now there will be times where it's like, I think a lot of us of this certain age or whatever, I'll be like, oh, I watched Hellraiser. And then the joke that you say like right after that, of course, is I was probably a little too young to watch Hellraiser, right?
Yeah, I was, but then you think about it, way too young.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, like, yeah, I would have been like 5 or something watching Hellraiser, and that's a lot. But I'm also like, I feel like it informed me in a lot of ways. So I'm always kind of on the line with that, where it's like, yeah, I don't think necessarily I would like let my niece or nephew watch Hellraiser with me, but I might not care if they did watch it, right? Because I'm just like, I think that obviously it's for the parents to decide, but I also am like, I think that Hellraiser had a really good effect on me. Like, I think that, like, there's a lot of problem solving going on in Hellraiser, the first two movies specifically. And there's a lot of commentary on, like, lust and how, I mean, you know, clearly commentary on, like, leather culture, which I was, like, not there yet. But, I mean, it kind of gives you, as a queer kid, you know, like it really entranced me in a lot of ways, similarly to how like Return to Oz did or something. I also think that kids can kind of handle it sometimes, but yeah. Then you were talking about like video nasty stuff, and that's 100% like censorship, essentially, right? Like that's people being like, oh, people cannot handle this, and especially not certain of a certain age, you can't handle this.
Of a certain age, and weirdly of a certain class. Like the kind of chief censor in Britain at the time was going around being just like, well, it's okay if you educated people watch the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but what if what if some like, you know, lower class working guy in a factory watches it? And it's just like, yeah, I think most people get that it's not like instructional, because how else do you ban the Texas Chainsaw Massacre? There's like a teaspoon of blood in the whole film. Everything's suggestion.
Yeah, 100%. And also, none of us really want to be Leatherface. That doesn't seem like a good situation.
Yeah.
I think it would be very strange to identify with Leatherface, like, on that level. Like, watching that movie, that's not necessarily the point, right? Of, like, but yeah, like, and that's such an interesting thing, too, because I do think class has a lot to do with it, but we see it a lot even now. That's, like, such a strong argument against a lot of things, but then it's, like, for instance, whenever Joker was coming out, right? I have no interest in this movie, so this is not a defense of Joker. I'm never going to watch that movie. But like the fact was is that like the second that movie got announced, everybody was like, oh, there's going to be all these angry young men watching this and taking some kind of message from it. And I think that the movie actively tried to court that audience, which like makes it be ridiculous, honestly, because like it didn't have that big of an effect. But, yeah. Like, people were very much, like, clutching their pearls about this one. And to me, it was like, yeah, but we just saw, like, the far right, like, take that cartoon frog and, like, turn that into a whole thing. It's like, that had no fascistic purpose, right? Like, that wasn't something that was, like, I mean, it was just a comic book about, like, a stoner frog. Like, there wasn't anything like right leaning intrinsically about that concept. And of course, like the creator was in a space where he was like, I don't know, like this is awful. Like, so it's kind of an interesting ongoing thing with that story specifically. But the thing that I take from that is that no matter what, if somebody is like being raised with like fascistic imagery and attitudes, then they will turn anything into a message for that, right? Because yeah. It's like, and like, obviously we like creators have a responsibility to not like actively try to court that audience. Like, I do think that that film did. And I do think that like a lot of movies do, but a lot of bands do. Like, you'll see like that happened a lot in like the punk scene where mm-hmm. there would be like bands that were like sporting like, you know, all of this like literal like SS stuff, you know, and all of this. So
yeah,
I think that that's
the
like
rockers, and when they talk about like how much they hated disco, and it's just like, well, we know what that means.
What that means that you're like not down with like black people or gay people. Yeah, exactly. 100%. So, but that's the thing too, is like, there's a, like such a thing as dog whistles, obviously, but like you look at stuff like that and it's just like, okay, but where do you draw the line? Because I mean, yeah, I can see why somebody thinks like, you know, watching somebody get hacked up with like a chainsaw, that's like it's the desensitivity argument too, because people will be like, oh, if you watch this all the time, then that brings down your sensitivity. And it's just like, I am horrified by horror movies. Like, I've been watching them my entire life, and I don't think that they made me have less empathy. Like, I have more empathy, I think, as a result of really understanding how badly a situation can go, and like be like, okay, like I have, and like the empathy that I have, I think the art that I consume very much helps me like bring that to the forefront of my life. So I think that that's something that goes across all of the genres that I'm interested in. But I think that horror has an active role in, like, a lot of horror is super strongly moralistic. Like, you have, yeah, like, Twilight Zone is always, like, a moral at the end of the story.
Occasionally the moral, I mean, I love the Twilight Zone, but occasionally the moral at the end of the story is, like, fuck this guy. Like, oh my god, I keep, like, I always think of that episode where the poor guy is in a safe when the nuclear apocalypse goes off, and all he wants to do is read, and then like the final note is just his glasses break, and it's the cruelest thing. It's like that and Mufasa. These are the two traumas of my early life.
Yeah, I'm gonna throw in the Velveteen Rabbit in there too, but like those three for sure. But that's the thing too, the Velveteen Rabbit is a horror story, right? Like, I mean, it's horrible. Like, the rabbit gets abandoned, and there's no way to stop it because you're leaving your childhood behind. Like, that's really scary, kind of.
But I guess that's kind of one of the kind of the small values that I can, you know, after I watched Ratatouille and Candyman, that I can kind of take, that like my job means something, is that like perhaps if you're outside of the prism of actually already being willing to give these films a chance, something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre versus the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake seems much of the same thing to you. And I feel that like at least if you have insightful, empathetic people writing about these films and analyzing these films, that we can, even if it doesn't kind of come out of the like horror fan community, we can at least acknowledge that distinction between ourselves. Because for a long time, I think, like, you know, Hollywood or whoever you would have put it down to, just kind of felt that we would accept any old shit, and the same formula and the same kind of hatred of women and the same sort of bland group of white people running from the same big scary dude. That has moved on. I'd like to think that, like, if I'm, well, you know, that was before my time, but like that's a legacy. Hopefully we are the final girls, and like more generally everybody can build on. But you know, it's still a very gatekeepery world. I was talking to Anna, the founder of the Final Girls, earlier about stuff that we really wanted to write about in the coming year for various people that we both work for, and she really wants to interview Brendan Fraser, and I really want to write about the film Nope when it comes out. And I was like, oh yeah, I've already emailed one of the magazines I work for and said that, you know, when they're doing press for Nope, I definitely want to interview Jordan Peele. I want to write a feature about this. And then I was, you know, say, tell her, ha, 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 what are they going to do? Ask the other black person on staff? And it's like, yeah, because it is just me. And it's like, exactly. And it's ridiculous. It's 2021.
I still hear, like, I'll go, I went to a viewing of, what was that movie, XX? Is that right? Mm, yeah. The kind of horror anthology. I went to go see it, and, like, the male introducer for the film was like 100% just being like, women don't exist in this genre, basically. And I mean, that movie came out in like 2017 or 2018, so it's like, maybe 2016, but it was like, no, women have definitely been in this genre by then. Like, you can no longer use that as like a excuse, right? Yeah. And then like, you go to be like, oh, okay, well, this guy sucks, but it's like, why couldn't they have found another person to introduce this movie when he was like obviously not the person to do it, right? Yeah. So like, I find that to be kind of like the ongoing thing is like, we can't just have diversity in one place. Like, it can't just be like, oh, here's all of these films by like women. It has to be like, and here's all of this these critical organizations, and here's like all of the different voices within those critical organizations, right? Like, it can't be how it was anymore. And I mean, that's the thing too, is like, I remember really recently people talking about like the fandom that sprung up around Jennifer's Body. Mm-hmm. And like, people were just like, kind of whoopsie doodle, people just missed out on this one. And it's like, no, it wasn't like a we missed out on it situation. It was like, critics panned it in some really upsetting ways. Like, that movie didn't get a fair shake because it was by women about teen girls. Like, that's a very specific thing to remember.
And I think there was a real desire to humble Diablo Cody, like a really like nasty thing of like that she had done sex work in the past. Who does she think she was coming out here and like having these platforms and getting these budgets? Like, I think that was fucking dark.
And the same, like, across the board with the creative team, right? Mm-hmm. And because it was like, there were women in key positions there. I believe the same of Megan Fox. Like, I think that, like, she has been just absolutely eviscerated by the press and is, like, one of those people where right now we're finally kind of letting her have, like, a comeback. But it's also just, like, why did it take that long? Like, she missed out on like 10 years of her career as like a top grossing actor because of how nasty people were to her after Jennifer's Body was released. So I think it's very ahistorical. Like, we're seeing this, like, already people are trying to just completely reduce the role that misogyny had in burying that film. And I think that happens a lot. Like, as we were talking about Ganja and Hess, we talk about a lot of these projects where it's just like the critics have a role in that. Like, the way that people talked about that movie was gross. Like, it's really stomach churning. You read some of those reviews and you're just like, this is just nasty. Like, this person clearly hates that this was made by women. Like, that's they are intentionally missing every point that the film makes because they can't get over the fact that it was made by women and it doesn't really center the male gaze at all. So I think all of that is really interesting. And as you said, speaks to the importance of critics, right? Like, kind of an ongoing thing.
If we matter at all beyond kind of content creation.
Right, which is like the struggle, right? Do we? Sometimes. But it saves my life. Like, this is something where, like I said, as a kid, like, reading critics, I loved to do it. Like, even whenever we were talking mostly about, you know, it was predominantly white critics, this was still something that was like an ongoing thing for me, where I was like, I want to think really hard about all of the art that I'm seeing.
Same.
Yeah, I can only imagine, right?
Yeah. So you end up with like a slight self-importance. I've kind of recently had like quite a lot of humbling things, because when I was kind of a aspiring critic, I always felt like the coolest thing you could introduce yourself at a dinner party would be as a critic. But of course, I thought that. And then, like, I actually became one and got to be able to say that. And I was like, oh, nobody thinks that's cool. Like, that was just a me thing.
Oh, yeah. And then, like, I think, too, with criticism, it's, like, one of those fields where people always talk to you like you just started yesterday. Like, yeah. It's, like, you there's no... unless you're like literally one of the straight white men that do it. Like, I feel like people have condescended to me on like such a profound level. And I'm like, I have written like 1,000 articles. Like, you can find me everywhere. Like, I am all over the internet. And when we're talking about, you know, comics criticism of the last like 5 to 10 years, I don't think anybody, like, you would have to be actively avoiding me to not see me, because I've been talking about like some of the most important things that have happened in comics. And it's kind of the same with horror, but it is such a gatekeepy like genre, I think, like even in the critical sphere, there's only so many, you know, there's only so many final girls. You know, there's like so much of other platforms that don't necessarily prioritize those voices. So, I have one. This has been a really fun conversation. I did not know what direction it was going to go in, and it's gone in some really fun ones. I am so glad, because the last person who I interviewed about a similar subject matter of like criticism and horror had very different things to say. And like, one of my fears of going into these interviews was being like, is everybody just going to be like repeating themselves and saying the same stuff? And it was just like, that really has not been the case.
No, we all have our individual traumas to work out with you.
Yes, we are all working out very individual existential crises, as you noted before the call began. So my last question is just kind of a fun one, honestly, which is there a time, or can you remember a series of times even, where you were extra excited to write a critical piece? Like, was there something that inspired you where you were just like, yep, I'm the one who needs to write this, and I'm jumping right on it, and like right after you saw whatever piece of art is in question?
You know, weirdly, it's a very, very negative one. And I think it's like, and I actually like, I think people assume that people enjoyed like writing bad reviews. And for the most part, right, that's not true. Like, that's not true to me. I like watching films that I love. But I recently saw Last Night in Soho, and I felt that like, as a woman who has got, you know, for many of us, we had like some mental health struggles, and I have, you know, strong opinions around the politics, around the way that we talk about sex work and mental health and race and young womanhood. And I grew up as a kind of young woman in Soho, and went to university in London and spent all my time in Soho. So it was very much everything about this film was felt like a million tiny betrayals to me. So I really wanted to sit down and write. Well, I wanted to write about it, and actually I didn't manage to, but I'm podcasting about it coming up, and I'm really interested to get into why that film pissed me off in so many, many different, and I like Edgar Wright, and I've liked to, you know, gotten from like love to like with virtually all his films. Maybe Baby Driver I was, you know, just lukewarm on, but for the most part I'm kind of rooting for him. And I hated that film. Well, I've been there, hate's probably a story. I was so disappointed by that film.
Sure. Yeah. And it sounds like in ways that are very specific of like what your experience is, which I think is a big one for me as well. I enjoy writing all kinds of pieces. And there's ones where I'm like, I want to write it because nobody has written from this perspective. Mm-hmm. I think that that's like one of my big ones was I remember writing about the legacy of the Stepford Wives as a property. And I was from what I could find, the first woman to write about it at length, like, which was wild. I mean, I hope that that's not still the case. Mm-hmm. Like, I hope somebody else has jumped in on that. But I remember at the time, like probably around like 2015 or 2016, I looked all over the internet and could not find a single thing by women about that film or that film franchise, because there's more than one. But yeah, I thought that was like very fascinating, and just one of those things where I was like, I can't believe that, kind of like, we've made it this far. I know that women have thoughts on this movie.
Yeah.
Like, it can't just be these like 10 once again cis straight white men who have feelings on the Stepford Wives, because it's kind of not necessarily for them in a way.
Yeah.
But Because it's commentary. Like, there's so much commentary in that book of how, like, men that identify as feminists will, like, sell you out, you know?
Yeah.
Like, which is, like, one of Ira Levin's great... I think one of the great things that he does in all of his books is to be like, don't trust progressive men.
Like, no, I do. I love, like, Ira Levin.
Yeah. And I think that that's what's interesting about a lot of his works is he's like, watch out for these guys because like they get close to you and you think that you can depend on them, but you super can't. Mm-hmm. And it's like, obviously a case by case basis, but his books are all about that, right? So, I think all of that's very interesting. But I think too that like whenever you're looking at something, it's like sometimes you just are the one who has to be like, hey, this is why this kind of sucked, right?
Yeah.
On the other hand, I feel like sometimes I'm the one who like jumps in to be like a little bit apologetic about things. Like, I remember everybody being really upset about like the lesbian representation in Ratched, and I was just like, I kind of like it. In a very like, I don't know, because it was like, I like queer villains, you mm-hmm. know, like nobody's really ever going to break me of that, even though it's like such a problematic history. So I was like, I don't know. I'll take it. I get all of the reasons to hate it, but
yeah.
I'll take it.
Well, I mean, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Like, you kind of
yeah.
don't, it's balancing between, like, you know, calling out crap when you see it and then trying to not be the fun police at the same time. I fundamentally think that we go into two groups where it's like, one is the people that kind of basically think almost everything's a 3-star film. And that's definitely me. And then ones that kind of everything's either 1 or 5.
And oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think you do get some slightly annoying, like, oh, well, this element offended me 1 star. And I'm just like, really? Really, this was like,
right.
You know, and I think some of the recent Candyman stuff, which I thought was a good film, but not a... I don't think it was a great film. I thought it was a very good film, and I thought it was a fantastically well-made film, but I do appreciate that there's an element of it, like, being slightly didactic and, like, you know, all the subtext is text, which, you know, sure. But, like, I think that then there was a little bit of a backlash from certain writers who I really respect of just being just like, well, this was, you know, a cheap way to look at this 1 star. And I'm just like, well, that's also, I mean, it's kind of twofold issues of like, A, I don't think like that's the way art works, like that it's either complete success or a complete failure.
Right.
And I also think that we put a little bit too much pressure on, you know, minorities to create perfect work, and like,
yeah,
you know, not everyone's Barry Jenkins and Steve McQueen, and like, not, you know, makes perfect films every time, unless I would say that they do. Or Michaela Cole, probably put her in there as well, you know. And I think like we have to give ourselves like a bit of 4-star space, 3 and 4 stars, why not? Most things are, like, you know. And it was almost, and I wonder whether even like in retrospect, something like Black Panther, like that had to be the best film ever. And I do think it was probably the best Marvel film ever, but like, it's, you felt that if it had just been okay, if it had been like a Thor 2, this would have been like a cataclysmic event for like, you know, the black superhero potential.
Yeah. It would have been viewed as, oh, well, see, that's why this doesn't work
yeah.
whenever we try to, like, include diversity. Because diversity doesn't sell has been, like, one of the big criticisms from, like, all of the execs for literally the whole time, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, like, such an ongoing thing where people would have just been like, oh, that didn't work, so we don't ever have to do it again.
Yeah.
You're listening to Bitches on Comics, distributed by Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away. Find more shows like Bitches on Comics by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm. Thank you for listening to Bitches on Comics. We are a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Twitter at @bitchesoncomics and on Instagram at @bitchesoncomics. Our website is brace yourself. bitchesoncomics.com. If you go there, you can listen to any of our episodes, and we've got other shit that we put on tabs. I don't remember what it is. I am in charge of updating the website, however, so good luck.
Thanks for the heads up. I'll go to this website now.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also support the podcast by joining us on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/queerspec to learn more.
I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm Essie Fleenor. You can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and you can find me at www.audreysrevenge.com or on Twitter at @AudreyRevenge.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.